little time to put together in black and white an operation of that nature, which has to be precise, delicate, and rapid, and where everybody has to be fully briefed on his own mission. Bizarre settled down in a corner of the headquarters command post, his own command post not being equipped for such mundane affairs as making plans and writing field orders, and worked frantically for the next 6 hours. At 2 o'clock in the morning of Sunday, March 28th, he was ready to brief the unit commanders, who would participate in the operation 4 hours later. Sunday, March 28th, 1954. The briefing held by Bizarre at 0200 was remarkable in many ways. He was a major commanding a battalion, who was orchestrating an operation involving 5 battalions, requiring air support that was to come from bases more than 200 miles away, and the firepower of more than 2 full artillery battalions commanded by a full colonel. Yet this was Bizarre, and the place was Dien Bien Phu, and no one seemed to mind. In fact, at Dien Bien Phu, all senior officers had decided, by common accord, to do away with the normal military formalities and to call each other not only by their first names, but also by the familiar French tu. Bizarre's briefing included not only the men directly concerned with the operation, the 3 airborne battalion commanders, Touré from the 8th Assault, Giraud from the 1st Foreign Legion paratroops, Captain Thomas, who now commanded the 6th BPC since Bizarre had been appointed commander of the counterattack forces, and Clemenceau, commanding the 1st Battalion 2nd Foreign Legion Infantry en Huguette, but also the gentle and scholarly-looking Captain Hérouet, who still commanded his tank squadron with both arms swathed in plaster casts, Colonel Bailon, who now commanded the artillery after Pirot's suicide, and, finally, the cadaverous-looking, for he was badly afflicted with amoebic dysentery, Air Force Major Guérin. The mission would be difficult. A regiment of the 308th Division, probably the combat-experienced tough Regiment 36, had been assigned to the defense of the flak positions. In the dishpan flat terrain on the west, salvation would lie in total surprise. A short but murderous artillery barrage, which the advancing infantry and tanks would follow as closely as possible, a rapid exploitation of the resulting chaos, and an equally quick withdrawal before the enemy could adjust his fire to the new situation. For, as the French had discovered, the only remaining weakness of the communist forces lay in their relatively inexperienced artillery commanders, who were not yet capable of shifting targets rapidly. Also, since the positions at Dien Bien Phu were stationary, the communists had dug in most of their field pieces so that they would cover a given sector and could not rapidly be trained elsewhere if the situation required it. Bizarre's plan was simple. The 6th and the 8th battalions would be on their line of departure in 0530 and ready to jump off at 0600, with the 8th facing Bon Bon and the 6th directly opposite Bon Ong Pet, having approached the target to a distance of 300 meters. Clemenceau's foreign legionnaires would stand by at 0500 in a backup position. The 1st BEP would remain in reserve at 0800 on a 5-minute alert basis. The artillery command had guaranteed Bizarre the use of 12 105s, 2 155s, and 12 120mm mortars to deliver a massive rolling barrage in 5-minute waves as of 0600. At 0615, one half of the artillery fire would begin to concentrate on the frontage of the 8th Assault Battalion, and the other half on that of the 6th BPC. Tank Platoon Carrette would support the advance of the paratroopers, and the Air Force fighters, on call as of 6:30, would seal off the battlefield and pin down the Viet Minh reserves. The whole operation came off without a hitch. To be sure, the Air Force fighters were delayed until 0900 by the extremely low clouds and poor visibility, but they very effectively attacked the 2 villages and the hills behind them. The enemy's resistance around Bon Ong Pet was stiff enough temporarily to pin down the 6th BPC. Then Préau and his tank platoon from Isabelle joined the fray and slammed into the southern flank of the communist position. 2 of the tanks were slightly damaged by communist bazookas, but by 1500, the wild melee was over, and the paratroopers looked around in amazement. The enemy was retreating in disorder, and the French remained masters of the battlefield. Moreover, the bodies of 350 Vietnamese communists littered the area, leaving intact 5 20mm anti-aircraft cannon, 12 50-caliber anti-aircraft machine guns, 2 bazookas, 14 automatic rifles, and hundreds of other weapons. 10 prisoners were later to tell their captors of the surprise and shock the enemy had experienced at seeing the supposedly demoralized French go over to the attack. Yet there weren't enough troops to hold and defend the conquered ground at Banong Pet and Ban Ban, particularly since it was overshadowed by the hill line behind it. Soon after 3 o'clock, Bijard gave the order to withdraw to the main line of resistance. While the boost in morale had been tremendous, even the defeatists in Hanoi, who, for days, had been going around saying that the garrison was foutu, cooked, took heart again. The price of the small sortie had been heavy. The 6th BPC had had 2 lieutenants, Vigouroux and Jacob, and 15 paratroopers killed, and 1 officer and 35 paratroopers wounded. The 8th assault had lost 3 paratroopers killed and 4 officers and 50 paratroopers wounded. With the other casualties suffered by the garrison during the relative lull during the second week of fighting at Dien Bien Phu, the total still amounted to 522, or almost a full battalion. These losses, despite the reassurances of General Cogny, had not been made up by parachuted replacements. French intelligence officers reported a total of 284 enemy dead for the week prior to the Battle of Banong Pet. Hence, the losses had evened out numerically, but the communists had 5 times as many troops on the line as the French, and were in a much better position to replace their losses. Far to the north, where 1st Company of the 5th BPVN had held Huguette 7 under constant enemy harassing fire since March 18th, its commander, Lieutenant Rondeau, was seriously wounded that day. He would stubbornly hang on to life until after the end of the siege, and replaced by Captain Bissar, who had been parachuted into Dien Bien Phu on March 26th. The situation had seriously deteriorated at the 2 northern Huguettes covering the airstrip. On March 27th, Major Seguin Passy had been forced to lead the better part of the 1st BEP and the 5th BPVN in a full-scale clearing operation, in the course of which 3rd Company of the Vietnamese paratroopers, reinforced by a company of the 8th Assault, pushed as far north as the ill-fated ford at Ban Khe Phai on the road to Gabriel. At 0200 of March 28th, Air Force Captain Thuyen Hoa of Transport Group 164 Bayern planned to take off from Hanoi's Gia Lam Airport as command pilot on aircraft Delta Coca No. 434. At the last minute, Fernois was replaced as senior pilot by Major Blanchet, the deputy commander of Group 164. This was a familiarization flight for Blanchet, since he had not yet participated in night landing missions of ambulance aircraft. The rest of the crew was already aboard, including the women's Air Force nurse, Geneviève de Gallard-Tarobe, when Blanchet climbed into the aircraft. As they approached the Dien Bien Phu strip at 0345, the enemy flak was at its most violent. In all likelihood, the ground personnel did not expect another landing that night, for the few minute landing lights which were usually left on to guide incoming aircraft were turned off. Blanchet nonetheless succeeded in landing his plane safely, but as it rolled toward the taxi stand, it veered into a barbed wire entanglement and developed an oil leak. Unable to work at it in total darkness, and aware that the communists would start firing at the aircraft at first light, the mechanics hit upon an ingenious stratagem. They pushed a wrecked C-47, with which the communist artillerymen already were familiar, to the location of the disabled Delta Coca, and put the Delta Coca in the place of the wrecked craft. They hoped that the communists would concentrate their fire on the wreck and leave the new arrival alone until it could be repaired. The ruse almost worked. During the early morning hours, the French assault on Banong Pet diverted communist attentions to other matters. But the heavy fighting also prevented the mechanics from working on the aircraft. By noon, however, the hole in the oil tank was patched up. 25 stretcher cases were again lying in the mud of the nearby airfield drain along with their nurse. Then the moment of truth came. The engines of the aircraft had to be started for testing and a brief warm-up before the wounded could be loaded. The starting of the engines and the turning of the propellers could not be hidden, even from the most obtuse Viet Minh artillery observers. With unerring precision, the shells began raining down on the aircraft. At 1300, hit by the 3rd shell, the aircraft began to burn. Fortunately, Major Blanchet and his crew escaped the burning plane. On hearing this news, Captain Tournoi attempted to land at Dien Bien Phu the following night, but heavy rainstorms prevented a landing. During the next night, the second enemy assault on Dien Bien Phu began. Major Blanchet became the deputy to Dien Bien Phu's air controller, Major Guerin. The other crew members joined Captain Charneau's Air Force detachment with 41 BEP. The nurse, Genevieve de Galard-Terrube, joined Major Groen's hospital. She was a modest girl, with blue eyes, brown hair, and a ready smile. To her, Dien Bien Phu was just an ambulance mission that aborted. No one there ever called her the Angel of Dien Bien Phu. This name was given to her by rear echelon press agentry. To the men at Dien Bien Phu, she was known as Genevieve. 6. Strangulation. Monday, March 29, 1954. The enemy now has adopted a new defensive system. He has abandoned the system of isolated strong points in favor of large centers of resistance, whose attack will require the commitment of important forces. Henceforth, the battalion shall not fight alone, but within a larger unit in cooperation with other friendly elements. Its successes or failures will have great repercussions throughout the whole regiment, the whole division, and sometimes upon the whole campaign. These were the first few lines of the new field manual on the attack of fortified positions by infantry battalions issued by the Viet Minh High Command shortly before the Dien Bien Phu offensive. The manual also stated that in order to attack such positions, an overall manpower superiority of 3-1 and a firepower superiority of 5-1 were necessary. After the opening of the first breach, one must immediately penetrate into the interior of the enemy fortified system and hold that penetration to the bitter end. With the sufficient concentration of forces on the principal point of effort, we are assured of being able to press home the attack to our advantage, no matter how strong the enemy defense is, thanks to successive assault waves. That would be General Giap's attack tactic through the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. It had already been used on Beatrice and Gabrielle. Now it was going to be employed on a large scale in what later became known as the Battle of the Five Hills, Dominique 1 and 2 and Elion 1, 2 and 4. Ever since March 20th, Major Nicolas Moroccans had had difficulty in keeping patrols and outposts on top of Old Baldy and Phony Mountains. Many men on patrols simply disappeared, or the next patrol found their bodies stabbed and stripped of their weapons and equipment. The French frequently had toyed with the idea of occupying Old Baldy in strength, but the idea was finally abandoned for lack of building materials and troops. In any case, the French artillery commander had assured de Castries that the enemy could be permanently kept off these strategic outlying hills by firepower alone. This proved to be another miscalculation. Lieutenant Colonel Longley instinctively felt that Bijard's attack had proven French strength and firepower in the lowland areas. He therefore believed the main communist effort would be redirected to the French hill positions. These were now all located east of the Nam Yum. If this high ground fell, the fate of Dien Bien Phu would be sealed. Hence, a desperate last-minute effort was made to reinforce the hill line. Dominique was reduced to its strong points 1, 2, 3, and 5. D6 no longer being held, while Dominique 4 became an independent strongpoint held by the 8th Assault Battalion of Major Touré, along with one platoon of the Quad 50s. This new strongpoint was baptized Epervier, Sparrowhawk. At the southernmost point of Dien Bien Phu's main position, Claudine 6 had been detached from the main position and had been transformed into a separate strongpoint known as Juno. It was placed under the command of Major Giraud and held by a mixed bag of the 1st BEP's Foreign Legion paratroopers, white ties, the remaining two Quad 50s of Lieutenant Redon, and finally, the Air Force detachment of Captain Charneau. But it was the Alliance that had received the heaviest reinforcements. In addition to the whole 1-4 Moroccan rifles which held Elion 1, 2, and 3, the latter also being defended by two companies of Thai auxiliaries under Lieutenant Martinez, there were now two companies and the headquarters of the 5th BPVN on Elion 4. In the small plain between the river and the hill line, a large part of the 6th BPC lay in reserve behind E4 and E12. E10 was held by a company of the 8th BPC under Captain Pichelin. E11 was held by a company of combat engineers, and E12 was held by parts of 2nd BT. The elite airborne battalions had lost much of their combat strength in the counterattacks of late March, and no one knew whether the tribesmen of 2nd BT would melt away if they were given the chance. but the Algerian and the Moroccan battalions were counted as solid units, although the Moroccans did not think too highly of the Algerians on their left flank. This seemed also to be the opinion of the new commander of the whole central redoubt, Lieutenant Colonel Langlais. The loss of an Algerian battalion on Gabriel probably influenced them more than the loss of a foreign legion battalion on Beatrice affected the remaining legionnaires. Therefore, Langlais decided to stiffen the key positions of the Five Hills with paratroops from the reserves. 4th Company of the 5th BPVN was alerted to reconnoiter D1 in preparation for relieving a company of the 3-3 RTA on the following day. A company of the 6th BPC moved to Elian 4, now held by Captain Botella and 2 of his companies. That day, the monsoon rains fell heavily on the valley, hampering supply drops and aerial reconnaissance. Isabelle's garrison succeeded once again in breaking through to Dien Bien Phu with an ambulance truck, carrying 5 seriously wounded patients for the main hospital. ACP No. 3 was now cleared of serious cases, but Groan had 175 seriously wounded men awaiting an air evacuation that never came. Nor did the men on Isabelle know that there would be no more convoys to Dien Bien Phu. The siege ring had become too tight. As night came and the artillery fell silent, Langlais and Badeau climbed out of their dugout for a breath of fresh air. Beyond Claudine and Huguette, the sky still glowed red, not from the setting sun, but from the napalm fires smoldering in the forest. But beyond the Five Hills, to the east, an incredible sight confronted the two officers. Like thousands of glowworms, torch-bearing columns of enemy soldiers or porters could be seen leaving the valley. To this day, it is not clear whether they were coolies who had brought supplies forward or soldiers relieved from duty in the first line. Either way, the strange ceremony was a radical departure from the enemy's usual caution and concern with concealment. "Look," said Badeau to Langlais, "they're getting the hell out of here. They're going to steal our battle away from us." Tuesday to Wednesday, March 30th to 31st, 1954. The night of March 29th was calm, save for light harassing fire by enemy artillery. Rain fell continuously. The troops in the open trenches of Claudine and in the drainage ditch of the airfield began a 40-day trial of knee-deep mud, wet clothes, and human excrement. Combat rations were eaten cold. Shortly before dawn, Lieutenant Delot, who commanded a platoon on Huguette 7, had gone 150 meters north of the position for the almost daily routine of flushing the enemy from the trenches dug during the night. He and his men had been in the habit of leaving some mines and booby traps for the Viet Minh to locate and defuse during the evening, but this time the work was proceeding with greater difficulty than usual. Apparently, the Viet Minh were learning from experience. They zeroed in several 120mm heavy mortars on their own worksite, which was also covered by the direct fire of a 57mm recoilless rifle. Nevertheless, Delot once again succeeded in his mission and returned to Huguette 7 at 0900 with only a few slightly wounded men. The calm continued throughout the day, with the rain hampering the enemy flak and the French supply planes in about equal measure. The anti-aircraft did not hit any of the planes, but the planes misdropped many of their supply loads. Langlais was worried, feeling that the situation at Dien Bien Phu was totally misunderstood in Hanoi. He therefore decided, with de Castries' agreement, to attempt to hitch a ride on one of the ambulance planes which was supposed to land that night. Langlais would see Cogny in Hanoi and obtain firm commitments for the all-out defense of Dien Bien Phu. He would fly back and parachute in on the following day. The plan never materialized. The battle would be fought with what was at hand. Langlais now decided to pay one last personal visit to each of the eastern strongpoints from north to south. At the headquarters of the Algerian battalion, he found the commander, Captain Jean Garandeau, down with the flu, but confident that he could withstand even a sizable attack. Langlais went along with him until he discovered that parts of the flanks of D2 were held by Thai auxiliaries and D5 by elements of the 2nd BT. Langlais exploded in fury and ordered Garandeau immediately to replace the Thai unit with his own regulars. He found the Algerians downtrodden and soggy in the rain. They did not inspire confidence. Yet there was nothing Langlais could do about it now. He could not commit his precious paratroop reserves to holding the line and then risk finding himself without reliable troops for immediate counterattacks. Longley felt much better about Allian. It had 3 battalion commanders present and paratroopers interspersed with the Moroccans. The vital cornerstone position of the entire defensive system, Allian II, appeared well defended. Nicolas, the commander of the 1-4 Moroccan Rifles, was well situated in the concrete cellar of the French governor's house. The ruins of the house, it will be remembered, had been used to build some of the works of E2. With its steep sides, the hill seemed almost unclimbable. The headquarters strongpoint dominated a flat stretch of terrain connecting it with the southeastern end of the hill. This flat stretch had been dubbed the Champs-Élysées. What concerned Longley about the southern part of Allian II was that it came fairly close to Old Baldy, whose round back, to a great extent, hid what went on behind it. At the same time, the French had been forced to abandon the patrolling of Phony Mountain. As the French artillerymen had predicted, the Communists never succeeded in establishing themselves on top of Phony Mountain. Instead, they had burrowed long tunnels right through it. The result was that while nothing changed on the observable surface of the hill, it had become a veritable honeycomb of Communist automatic weapons and recoilless rifles. On E2 also, Longley wanted to make certain that the best available men were in the forward positions. He decided to reinforce the 2nd Company, 1-4 Moroccan Rifles, of Captain Nicole, with a company of tough paratroopers from the 1st BEP. A 1st platoon from Lieutenant Luciani's company arrived late in the afternoon, looked at Old Baldy looming close by, then looked with utter disgust at the shallow trenches dug by the Moroccans. They immediately began to dig deep. The going was slow, however, as the hill contained just about the only rocks available around Dien Bien Phu. With the forces at his disposal, Longley had done his best. The key strong points had been provided with at least a thin veneer of first-class troops. The bulk of the paratroop reserve now was on the eastern side of the Nam Yum and would not have to cross its bridges under fire. Ney's tank platoon was ready to go into action, and even the Quad 50s from Juneau had registered their redoubtable 8 barrels from 1,000 meters away on the flanks of E2. By 1800, orders had been given to the battalions to see to it that all men received warm food that evening, and that the food be brought to the men before 1800. On Dominique, this schedule was being strictly adhered to. On D1, food was being distributed, and the paratroopers from 4th Company, 5th BPVN, were in the process of moving in with their weapons and equipment to take the place of the Algerian company there. The men were bunched up in the communications trenches, collecting their equipment and other paraphernalia. This was the precise moment that the murderous communist artillery barrage began to land on all the Dominiques, Allians, and the headquarters area. The battle for the 5 hills had begun. Within a few minutes, the world seemed to be coming apart on top of Dominique and Allian. The assault waves of 2 communist divisions began to follow the rolling barrage. Lieutenant Raboul's 2nd Foreign Legion Medium Mortar Company on D1 took heavy casualties before its gunners could fire their first volley. It was the final hour for D1 and D2. Thanks to its careful preparatory work, the enemy infantry emerged from its approach trenches and blasted its way through the minefields and barbed wire so rapidly that the prearranged French defensive fires fell far beyond the communist assault waves. On D1, the Algerians and Thai partisans disintegrated. In order to stop the panic, the commander of the relieving paratroop company of the 5th BPVN, Lieutenant Martinet, ordered his men to shoot anybody who fled. Completely sealed off, the paratroopers, the Algerian non-commissioned officers, and the survivors of the mortar company fought on to the last man. Their sacrifice against an enemy at least 10 times more numerous bought time for the rear area of Dominique. At 21:50, D1's radio fell silent. On D2, disaster came even more swiftly. At 1900, Bizard radioed Longley, who was following the battle from Gaucher's headquarters, that the Algerians with Captain Garandeau had broken completely and were running away in direction of the Nam Yum. Longley had believed in the intrinsic strength of D2 and was impressed by the assurances of its commander. This now proved to be an error. Garandeau, as it behooved him, stayed in the debris of his strongpoint and disappeared with it at 20:00. Tiny Dominique V, rather symbolically held by 5th Company, 2nd BT, obviously was in no position to stop anything. Everything now hinged on D3. If it fell, the whole Lelian position would be outflanked, and communist assault troops would cross the Nam Yum River within hours and overrun the unprotected headquarters area. The battle for Dien Bien Phu would be over. Yet, all there was on D3 in the way of infantry was yet another company of Algerians whose morale was, if anything, lower than that of the garrisons of D1 and D2. The Algerians had witnessed their compatriots' destruction and had felt the impact of communist artillery. There was another unit on D3, the African artillerymen of Lieutenant Brunbrook's 4th Battery, 2nd Battalion, 4th Colonial Artillery Regiment. With night closing in, Algerian riflemen fleeing in all directions, and the green-clad waves of communist infantry clearly visible against the flaming outlines of Dominique's 1 and 2, the gallant gunners in their open pits depressed their field pieces to minimum elevation and began to fire volley after volley point-blank into the massed infantry. And a miracle happened. The 312th People's Army Division was too close for artillery support from its own pieces. The assault waves halted and recoiled from the blazing guns. Then the Quad 50s on Sparrowhawk began firing. Their murderously effective slugs began to trace fiery lines in the night sky as they began to find their mark on the slopes. The lines of communist infantrymen stopped, wavered, and began to seek protection in the narrow valley behind D6. In their panic, they ran straight into a new minefield which Longley had laid a few days earlier. 200 Viet Minh perished there. While the battle was being contained on Dominique, Elion was under heavy attack by the bulk of the 316th Division. At the sight of the collapse of the Algerians, the two Moroccan companies on Elion also began to waver. By 1900, Botella reported from E4 that Moroccans fleeing from E1 were crossing his position, but that his own men were holding up well under fire. Farther to the south, Elion II had been under fire since the beginning of the battle and was being plowed under by communist artillery. The communist recoilless rifles and heavy machine guns buried in the sides of Phony Mountain now revealed themselves with devastating effect. Almost nothing was left of the Champs-Élysées trenches, and by 2100 there were only a corporal and 6 Foreign Legion paratroopers left of the force that had dug in at the southern tip of E2 4 hours earlier. At 2150, the fire suddenly lifted on E2. French flare shells spread their ghostly light over the no-man's land between Old Baldy and Elion. It was crawling with enemy infantry rising out of the ground. At 2210, there was nothing left of the French garrison in the southern half of E2. The surviving Moroccans grimly held on to battalion headquarters in the ruins of the French governor's residence. At 2300, Major Nicolas' radio on E2 ceased to answer the anxious queries from Longley's command post. There, Longley was fighting a complex struggle against a conflicting set of high-priority demands, since, in addition to the battle for the Five Hills, a communist stab by elements of the 308th Division developed against dangerously exposed Huguette 7. Young Lieutenant Thélot and Sergeant Clotre had been killed by a direct hit of a 57mm shell through the porthole of their bunker. The rest of the 1st Company, 5th BPVN, seemed in serious trouble as Viet Minh infantrymen began to pour into the gap left temporarily by the silent northern bunker on H7. Longley curtly turned down a request from Major Clemenceau on Huguette for a company to counterattack on H7. The battle for the Five Hills had to command his attention, for if Elion fell that night, whatever happened on Huguette would be academic. One question remained: should Longley retake the lost positions immediately through night counterattacks, or should he await daylight? It is interesting, on such an occasion, to witness the tricks a man's memory can play upon him. Colonel Longley himself affirms in his account of the battle that if Dien Bien Phu was not lost that night, it was due largely to the fact that the enemy, surprised by the rapidity with which it had reached objectives for which it expected to fight all night, had been unprepared to exploit its initial breakthrough. Longley also felt that a night counterattack on the lost positions was impossible. It would be done tomorrow, if there was going to be a tomorrow. The facts as described in unit diaries by other participants and the record of radio messages sent by de Castries' headquarters to Hanoi seem to indicate otherwise. In actual fact, Lieutenant Luciani and the remaining paratroopers of his company had begun to counterattack in the direction of the summit of E2 shortly after midnight. In brutal hand-to-hand fighting, this mixed force of Frenchmen, Moroccans, and Foreign Legion paratroopers threw back the enemy and pushed him downslope along the Champs-Élysées. As the counterattack progressed, two tanks from Platoon Ney joined the fray, reinforced by parts of yet another company of the 1st BEP, led by Lieutenant Fournier. As morning dawned, the haggard defenders of Éléonne could look down at the carpet of enemy bodies covering the slopes all the way from Éléonne to Old Baldy. That counterattack might well have failed at a particularly crucial moment shortly before midnight, when Langlais, exhausted and under the terrific strain of the emergency radio messages from 5 infantry battalions and the artillery, assumed that the silence of Nicolas and the 1-4 RTM on top of Éléonne 2 meant that the unit had been destroyed. In actual fact, there seems to have been a temporary error in wavelength setting, for while Langlais could not hear Nicolas, the latter was heard very clearly by Bijard sitting in a foxhole on Éléonne 4. Fortunately, Bijard listened in both on the channel of E2 and on Langlais' command channel, where around midnight he picked up Langlais' order to the artillery to keep up a continuous barrage on the center of E2, precisely where Nicolas and his Moroccans were making their last stand.
"Hold everything," said Bijard. "This is Bruno speaking. Nicolas is still holding, and if you can't hear him, it's because your set is off-channel, but he can't hold out till daybreak by himself. I am sending him one of my companies."
Bijard thereupon dispatched Lieutenant Trapp and his company to Éléonne 2, not that he wasn't under attack, for E4 was now in the front line. 3rd Company 5th Vietnamese Paratroops was bearing the brunt of the battle. This company lost what it could least afford to lose, 3 of its French officers. Its whole weapons platoon was wiped out. Finally, on H7, a surviving platoon non-com, Sergeant Tunera, had taken over the defense of the northern bunker and, in bitter hand-to-hand fighting, had sealed the Viet Minh breakthrough. At 0530, Huguette 7 was once again in French hands. While the casualties had been heavy, the French would lose 2,093 men between March 28th and April 2nd, they had once more averted disaster. It is difficult to assess now whether Colonel de Castries did not play a particularly meritorious role that night of March 30th to 31st, when, according to various eyewitnesses, it was he who decided not to wait until the morning for the counterattacks on Éléonne 2 and threw in the hastily assembled paratroop and Foreign Legion companies. Apparently, the disastrous lessons of Béatrice and Gabriel had not been lost on the French. The later the counterattack, the more time the enemy would then have to consolidate the conquered position, to cover it with his artillery fire, and also to reinforce it with fresh troops. The biggest job still remained. Dien Bien Phu would never again be secure if Dominique 2 and Éléonne 1 remained permanently in communist hands, particularly D2, which, with its 505-meter altitude, dominated the whole position. Before collapsing from lack of sleep, he had been on his feet since dawn of March 30th, Langlais, together with de Castries, Séguin Passy, and Bijard, had decided to launch a full counterattack in the afternoon of March 31st, including practically the whole GAP2, 6th BPC, 8th BPC, parts of the 5th BPVN, reinforced by Major Grand Desnon's 3rd Battalion, 3rd Foreign Legion, which would make its approach march all the way from Isabelle, along with Lieutenant Préaud's tank platoon. Captain Herbouet's Bisons would also be thrown into the fight, and so would all the artillery that could be spared. The artillery had suffered frightfully under the enemy's fire. On March 30th, there had been 21 out of 24 105mm howitzers available, along with 3 heavy 155s. On March 31st, there remained 18 howitzers, 2 155s, and 17 out of 32 120mm heavy mortars. On April 1st, at 0430, when the losses of the previous day had been tabulated, Dien Bien Phu notified Hanoi that the artillery was in very bad shape. With the destruction of 3 more heavy mortars during the day, its effectiveness was one half of what it had been. It had also suffered 85 casualties, which depleted the gun crews almost to the point where they could no longer service the available field pieces. Furthermore, the artillery on March 31st had nearly exhausted its ammunition. The 17 105s fired an incredible 13,000 rounds that day, while the heavy mortars fired 1,200 rounds, and the remaining 155s expended 855 shells. March 31st brought an improvement in the weather.
The rain ceased during the day, and the C-119s, with their American pilots, and the French Bearcats and Helldivers, began to appear in the sky. What de Castri and Longley and Bijard were anxiously awaiting, and upon which the success of the counterattack hinged, failed to come. Airborne reinforcements. The last French parachute battalions available in Indochina were now assembled in Hanoi. They were also perhaps the best, made up of mainland Frenchmen and foreign legionnaires, with a solid admixture of little Vietnamese, and reinforced by the remaining elements of the 35th Airborne Artillery, RALP. Despite the fact that the units had recently participated in severe combat operations in Laos, they had been reinforced by newly arrived replacements and were at full strength. The first of these battalions to be parachuted into Dien Bien Phu, the 2nd Battalion of the 1st Parachute Light Infantry Regiment, 21RCP, had a tradition of daring paratroop operations going back to the British Red Beret Special Air Service of World War II. It was commanded by tough, aggressive Major Jean Bréchignac, known as Bresch, the Breach, to everybody, who recently had established his reputation by capturing the whole headquarters of the Communist 325th Division in Laos. The next battalion slated for Dien Bien Phu was Major Hubert Liesenfeldt's 2nd BEP, with its mixture of ex-Nazi Germans, ex-anarchist Spaniards, and wholly non-political Vietnamese. Lastly, there was the 1st Colonial Parachute Battalion under young Captain Guy de Bazin de Bazin. This was a veteran outfit, which had first landed in Indochina in February 1947 and now was on its second tour of duty in Vietnam. With its 911 men, of whom 413 were Vietnamese, it was the largest airborne battalion in Indochina. As early as the evening of March 30th, de Castri had requested the parachuting of an additional battalion, but had been temporarily turned down, apparently because Hanoi could not make up its mind as to whether Dien Bien Phu was worth the additional sacrifice of a battalion, or whether it should be allowed to die with what it already had. Yet no satisfactory reason has ever been provided for what was to happen later. At dawn, the 3-3 Foreign Legion and Preaux's tanks left Isabelle for the planned breakthrough to Dien Bien Phu. Scarcely 2 kilometers north of Isabelle, they fell on the communist blocking position at Ban Co Lai and Ban Nong Hai. There was no way of making an end run around this position. To go closer to the mountains on either side of the valley would have invited sure disaster at the hands of the enemy artillery. To cut across the flooded rice fields off Road 41 would have slowed down the operation to a crawl. People's Army Regiment 57 was ready and waiting for the Foreign Legion task force when it reached the enemy position. Recoilless rifles and bazookas now disclosed themselves, and 2 enemy infantry pincers appeared on both sides of the battalion. By 0900, the unit was completely pinned down, and tank Neumach had sustained a direct bazooka hit and had to be towed back. By 1150, the 3-3 Foreign Legion was fighting for its life. Far from supporting the main effort at Dien Bien Phu, the legionnaires now had to divert artillery fire to cover their withdrawal, with Viet Minh infantry in hot pursuit. Only the tanks prevented the retreat from becoming a disaster. Even so, the battalion lost 15 dead and missing, and brought back 50 wounded to overcrowded Isabelle. This operation confirmed the fact that breakthroughs to Dien Bien Phu would henceforth be impossible. Isabelle was alone. The paratroop counterattack on Elion and Dominique began at noon, with Bijard commanding the operation from E4. Anxiously, the senior commanders scrutinized the radiant sky for banjos, the code name for troop-carrying airplanes, in the hope that a last-minute effort from Hanoi would give them the extra manpower needed. In the meantime, Touré, of the 8th Assault, would be responsible for the main push on D2. Whereas Bijard's own 6th BPC, under Captain Thomas, and parts of the 5th BPVN would take Elion 1, the main weight of the counterattack fell to the 8th Assault, which had to cross almost 400 meters under fire, climbing a rise of 150 meters over the distance. They left their line of departure at 13:30 with Captain Pichelin's company in the lead. Pichelin, his American carbine flung over his right shoulder and his steel helmet overshadowing his long, angular face, climbed silently upward behind the barrage of French artillery and mortar shells which now obscured the summit of D2. One of his friends used to say of him that Pichelin was a purebred who will gallop until his heart bursts. At 14:30, Pichelin and his men, quickly followed by the bulk of the 8th Parachute Assault Battalion, entered the smoking hell that was the top of Dominique II. nothing recognizable remained of the French positions of the day before. Hundreds of Viet Minh and French bodies covered the hill. Hit time and again by shell fragments, they had begun to rot in the sun. With the French and the Communists in close combat on top of the position, the artillery on both sides ceased firing on the hill. The enemy, almost a regiment strong, immediately regrouped for the counterattack. Yet Captain Pichelin, in his last moments on earth, had the satisfaction of knowing that the 8th Assault had retaken D2. He died a few minutes later from an enemy machine gun burst. On Elian 1, the little Vietnamese of the 5th BPVN, whose heroic conduct of the last few days had made up for their failure at the Ford to Gabriel on March 15, had determinedly pushed onward to E1 along with the 6th BPC. E1 had been even more thoroughly devastated after 20 hours of continuous shelling than D2. There were no shelters, no dugouts, no barbed wire, just the pockmarks of shells, the shattered bodies, and the stench of rotting human flesh. As soon as the Communists were driven from the position, Viet Minh counter-battery fire slammed into the reconquered hills. The paratroop battalions were winning their battle at a heavy price. It was now time for the reserves to relieve them. At 1500, Bijar reported to Longley that all objectives had been reached, but that now reinforcements were absolutely essential to retain the gains of the day.
No news from Brechignac?
Nothing from Hanoi. We don't know what the hell they are doing.
What Hanoi appeared to have been doing was attempting to make up its general staff mind. As far as can be established, General Cogny had had a social engagement, which had taken up part of his evening, and did not even bother to meet his commander-in-chief when the latter arrived at Hanoi on March 31st at 0115. Navarre was briefed on the situation during the night. According to Ra, whose views are not unsympathetic to Cogny, the latter finally arrived at his office at 0745 and gave the waiting Navarre a briefing based on the information received before midnight the day before. Then, General Navarre later told Ra, I exploded. I bawled him out. And he in turn told me to my face all that he had been telling others for some time. It was theoretically still possible to dispatch the 2-1 RCP on airborne alert in the paratroop barracks near Jialam Air Base, save for one fact, the density that enemy daytime flak had reached over the valley. One C-47 aircraft which tried to come in low on March 31st was promptly shot down. Even the speedy Navy hell divers from the aircraft carrier Aramanche, who were loved by the paratroopers for the risks they took and for which they paid a higher price in lives than the Air Force, found it almost impossible to get through. During the morning of March 31st, the squadron leader of Carrier Squadron 3F, Lieutenant Andrew, and his gunner, Petty Officer 2nd Class Janik, were caught in the crossfire of several flak batteries near Beatrice. Their plane was destroyed, and both men were killed. It had therefore been decided not to risk massive daytime paradrops, which could result in excessive casualties. Nevertheless, there is little doubt that Cogny's presence during the night of March 30th could have resulted in a decision to order the timely parachuting of the 2-1 RCP into Dien Bien Phu before dawn of March 31st. This timetable would have given it ample time for rest and orientation before the noontime attack. The two paratroop battalions that had bled all day to hold the high ground had now reached the end of their tether. There would be no relief force. There would be no reinforcements from the rest of Dien Bien Phu, where Longley had already scavenged everything that could be depended upon not to disintegrate as soon as it was put into the line. From his open hole on top of E4, where he had been living for the last 48 hours amidst the continuous crashing of mortar shells and the unnervingly persistent waterfall noise of his radio sets, Bijard had to make the agonizing decision voluntarily to give up his conquests of the day or to lose his remaining troops and the terrain within hours.
I've got no reserves for you,
he radioed to Touré, who was still clawing his way through the last enemy pockets of resistance atop D2.
If you can't hold it, pull out.
At 1530, the 8th Assault did just that. There was an audible triumphant chatter as the first waves of Viet Minh infantry again swarmed over the top of D2. Under the circumstances, any attempt to defend little D5, hopelessly overshadowed by D2, became pointless. Bijar ordered Touré to pull back the tie for a final stand on D3. There was no point in further exposing the three remaining howitzers of Lieutenant Brunbrook to the oncoming enemy infantry. As dusk set in, the tall Africans lifted the heavy field pieces out of the mud and, with the help of the remaining trucks, towed them under fire across the Bailey Bridge over the Nam Yum towards Strongpoint Claudine. With D2 gone, E1 was again badly outflanked. At 1800, with a heavy heart, Bijard ordered his troops to pull back to E4. At headquarters, even the indomitable Longley was overcome by the hopelessness of the situation. There were no reserves left, ammunition reserves, even if the remaining cannon could sustain the fantastic firing rate of the past day without bursting, were barely sufficient for another day's fighting. Moreover, on the evening of March 31st, Dien Bien Phu had exhausted its hand grenades and 81mm mortar shells. The cruelest blow came in the form of a brief message from intelligence. General Giap had arrived in the valley and had personally taken over command of the battle from General Huang Van Tai. A Chinese general, Li Chenghu, said to be Giap's advisor, was reputed to have arrived with him. The enemy had apparently decided to finish off the hill positions that night. Giap was fully aware of the crucial importance of the eastern hills. In the revised edition of his book, Dien Bien Phu, Giap notes that Hill A1, the most important of the five hills, is the last defensive bastion of the central sector, and the struggle for it was particularly fierce. At about 2200, Longley informed Bijard that he was free to judge for himself whether the remnants of Dominique and Elion could be held for the night. Everything now hinged on the decision of a relatively junior officer who, for the past week, had been discharging the responsibilities of a brigade commander under the worst possible conditions, and who, for the past 48 hours, had barely eaten and scarcely slept. Bijard's answer came over the ANPRC-10 radio circuit, on which most battalion commanders, as well as the communists, who were fully equipped with captured radio sets, could listen in.
Mon colonel, as long as I've got one man left alive, I'm not going to let go of Elion.
Elion now meant Elion II. As night fell, the dark green hordes of communist infantry began to emerge from behind Old Baldy, poured over the destroyed barbed wire entanglements of the southern end of E2, and began to mount the blood-drenched Champs-Élysées corridor. Lieutenant Luciana and his mixed bag from the 1st BEP, Moroccans from the 1-4 RTM, and Lieutenant Rancoul's composite outfit of Legionnaires and Thai from the 1-2 REI were ready for them. The situation now seemed hopeless. The numerical superiority of the enemy infantry, there were probably almost 2 enemy regiments committed to the attack, was so overwhelming that the French garrison would obviously be trampled under the wave of humanity surging at it. At this moment, precisely at midnight of March 31st, the throaty rumble of Captain Herbouet's M24 tanks was heard churning across the Bailey Bridge and clattering over Road 41 into the hills. But the enemy was prepared. Determined 57mm recoilless rifle teams were waiting for the tanks. A communist source has given us a vivid description of the tank counterattack on E2. It takes the form of a Viet Minh forward artillery observer reading off firing indications in a simple code language that surely could have fooled no one who bothered to listen in. Customers right on red line. Request manager to settle accounts. 2 of my customers' oxen have knocked down coffee shop. Request boss deliver at once pumpkins, gourds, melons. Immediately after his calls, shells of all sizes rained on the black swarm of infantry and roaring tanks, which were climbing uphill. The smoke cleared off, the black enemy swarms thinned out substantially. Another attack was repelled. The communist narrator was not exaggerating. In Sergeant Ney's leading tank platoon, the tanks Ettlingen and Smolensk were hit by 57mm shells, the first 6 times and the latter 2. But both were able to continue the fight. At 0400, Herbouet himself, with both arms in plaster casts, decided to lead the remaining tanks of Warrant Officer Carret's platoon into combat. This time the mass of armor, small though it was, succeeded in blunting the enemy's attack and in holding it back. But the enemy's troops were also elite forces, and they did not yield easily. The command tank Bazeya sustained a direct bazooka hit in its vitals and exploded into flame, wounding Herbouet, Carret, and Sergeant Salan. Tank Mulhouse also sustained a bazooka hit, but stayed in the fight to the end.
As dawn broke, Luciani and his mixed bag of troops still held on to the high part of Eleon II. Bijard and the rest of the 6th Colonial Paratroops still held Eleon IV, and the 8th Paratroop Assault Battalion still held Dominique III. On top of E2, the black carcass of Tank Bazaia would become a landmark like the lone banyan tree which stood near the ruins of the French governor's residence, whose bare limbs pointed skyward like the hand of a skeleton. On Huguette 7, the heavy mortars of the 312th Division had maintained the gaping breach in the northern bunker where Sergeant Tuner was still holding on with the survivors of Lieutenant Delos' platoon. Unable to get reinforcements, Captain Bizarre decided to exploit the apparent inability of the Viet Minh regulars to adjust to an unforeseen situation. Bizarre pulled out from the northern and central portion of the strong point and withdrew into the two southern bunkers that were still left intact. At 2300, the enemy began its assault with mechanical precision, shelling the abandoned northern bunker and then entering the central portion of the strong point, in which there was little room for maneuver. At this moment, the French artillery plastered the area with high explosives. As April 1st dawned, 1st Company, 5th Vietnamese paratroops, led by a French captain, rose from its bunkers and holes and charged with a loud yell into the remnants of the Viet Minh force. By 10:35 that morning, all of Huguette 7 was again in French hands. Thursday, April 1st, 1954. April began with cloud cover over the valley. On Eleon II, a company of the 6th BPC and Luciani's surviving Foreign Legion paratroopers once more barreled down the Champs-Élysées in an attempt to improve their hold on the hill. But the enemy was back in force, and his artillery and mortars had again zeroed in on the lost terrain. The attack was stopped after the BEP had lost yet another 16 dead, 27 wounded, and 4 missing. Indeed, both paratroop battalions had suffered heavy casualties during the past week. The 6th BPC had lost 46 dead and 183 wounded, and the 1st BEP had paid for the toehold on Eleon with 40 dead, 189 wounded, and 8 missing, including 5 officers and 11 sergeants. Nonetheless, the counterattack permitted the recapture of a French 120mm mortar and the improvement of the position in the direction of E1. That day, Bijard, for valor on E2, raised Corporal René Sentignac to the rank of sergeant. Sentignac was to die 4 years later from an Algerian nationalist bullet in the sands of the Sahara, still fighting alongside Bijard. Lieutenant Rancoul's mixed bag Foreign Legion Company, which had suffered heavy losses on E2 the night before, returned to its home battalion on Huguette. There, another mixed company under Lieutenant Sposio began the dangerous trek north to relieve the badly exhausted 1-5 BPVN on Huguette 7. After their victory of the previous night, the little Vietnamese paratroopers of Captain Bizarre wore themselves proudly as they marched across the whole camp under intermittent artillery fire. They had proved that they could fight just as well as the next paratroop outfit, if well led and given a clear mission. At 1400, a radio message came in from outlying position Francoise, 1 kilometer west of Huguette, where for the past 2 weeks, Warrant Officer Comte had commanded 2 small Thai auxiliary companies. As on Almerie, the Thai, frightened by the continuous artillery fire, the constant trickle of losses on patrols, and swayed by enemy propaganda, were disintegrating. In contrast to what happened on the forward positions of Almerie, on Francois, the process was gradual enough for 1st and 2nd companies of the 1-2 REI to move out and pick up the mortars and machine guns of the little strongpoint before falling back with its French and Thai cadres. Longley was disgusted with the performance of the Thai auxiliaries, although it must be remembered that they were not trained for trench warfare. He ordered that all save the non-commissioned officers be disarmed and used as coolie labor. In fact, the Thais were not much use as laborers either. They melted into the maze of abandoned dugouts and trenches in the cliffs of Dominique and the banks of the Nam Yum, where they joined hundreds of Algerian, Moroccan, and Vietnamese deserters who had left their units on the battle line and were now living on a separate island within the dying fortress. They made nightly forays, stealing parachuted supplies and even weapons and ammunition. They operated a brisk black market, and unit commanders in some cases had to beg them to surrender precious misdropped special foods for the hospital or batteries for the radio sets, At one time or another, Longley thought of actually attacking the rats of the Nam Yum, as they were known in the camp, but he abandoned the idea when it became clear that such a firefight inside the camp could lead to the complete collapse of some North African and Vietnamese units who were hanging on with their French and Foreign Legion comrades to the bitter end. Every prolonged siege has known the phenomenon of internal desertion, and Dien Bien Phu was no exception. At one point, the paratroopers and legionnaire neighbors of the rats of the Nam Yum neatly solved the problem of their somewhat negative contribution to the defense of Dien Bien Phu by sealing off the communications trenches around the deserters' area, thus compelling them, in case of an enemy attack, either to fight it out in order to preserve their skins or to leave their rat holes and surface, thus ensuring their destruction. At 0900, an important conference took place in Hanoi to assess the new situation at Dien Bien Phu. It included General Cogny and his deputy for logistics, Brigadier General René Masson, General Deschaux from the French Air Force, and several of the key staff officers of the Northern Command. Cogny was concerned with the possibility of using once more one of the southern drop zones, such as Simon and Octavie, which had been suggested by Dien Bien Phu as alternates to the murderously difficult approach to the main DCs inside the perimeter. Colonel Nicot, the commander of air transport, argued heatedly that his planes would have to fly a prolonged course at a 300-meter altitude in the face of heavy flak and would be massacred. And Colonel Sauvagnac, in charge of all paratroop replacements, added that the same argument held for his paratroopers, who would be at the total mercy of enemy fire for a full 5 minutes before they could be regrouped. Deschaux also argued against the southern DZs for another reason. Their exact location had been compromised by being described over the radio, without any attempt at concealment, by Dien Bien Phu to a command aircraft on March 31st. Instances of similar laxness in communications security were picked up in mid-April by French press observers flying over Dien Bien Phu and must be taken into account as one of the reasons for the incredible precision of communist flak fire. Sauvagnac then proposed what, to him, was the only possible solution, the nighttime dropping of personnel by single planes coming in at irregular intervals. He argued against the massive drop of complete battalions, however, both because of the possibility of high losses and because of the overwhelming worries, souci et croissance, of the supply problem. There is no point increasing it for a very uncertain advantage. Most of the other senior officers present approved the idea immediately, thus depriving Dien Bien Phu of the massive reinforcements which would have been its only salvation, and which could have, on the previous day, saved the Dominiques. In characteristic fashion, Cogny approved the opinion of his subordinates and concluded that a massive airdrop of reinforcements could reasonably take place only outside the valley, either in the form of a battalion which could attempt at joining Dien Bien Phu, or by an extension of the battle through acting on the enemy's rear areas. In other words, Cogny, on April 1st, had abandoned all hopes of reinforcing the garrison as such, but was still willing to risk perhaps 30,000 of his troops for a diversionary operation from the Red River Delta. Both of those decisions, the record of the conference shows, were left for the Commander-in-Chief, Navarre, to make. The only decision that Northern Command had taken upon itself to execute in full, in the meantime, was to starve the garrison of reinforcements, or to dribble them in parsimoniously. The results were obvious. Inside Dien Bien Phu, every man willing and able to fight became a prized commodity. Units were shuffled squad by squad to reinforce existing positions. The arrival of the 1-2 REI's flamethrower team on Elion 2 on the night of April 1st was considered a significant reinforcement. At last, at 20:30, the drone of transport aircraft was heard over the valley. The banjos were bringing in the 2-1 RCP. Suddenly, all hell broke loose. The Viet Minh flak opened up on the lumbering transports, which had to come in on a prescribed course directly over the lower end of the airstrip. The DZ had shrunk to less than 500 meters in length and barely covered the width of the taxi strip. In addition, it was cluttered with the jagged wrecks of over a dozen aircraft, and it was impossible to parachute the men faster than one half a stick at a time. The strain on the pilots, compelled to fly a steady pattern in a narrow valley in which they were buffeted by the blasts of the friendly artillery, was incredible. while the rest of the transport group flew a holding pattern, 4th Company of 2-1 RCP under Lieutenant Subregi and Warrant Officer Rebron, plus a command element of the battalion and a gun crew from the 35th Airborne Artillery, succeeded in hitting ground at the price of 7 casualties, 5 of them sustained in midair. The rest of the battalion had to return to Hanoi because the slowness of the troop drops prevented the dropping of the urgently needed ammunition and other supplies. At Long Le's command post, the results of the airdrop of that night were considered catastrophic. If men were to be fed into the fortress at that rate, there was no way to make up for each day's losses, let alone reinforce the depleted battalions. And depleted they were. The BEP and the 6th BPC had 4 small 100-man companies each, and that day Botella had reorganized his decimated 5th BPVN into 3 companies, with the strength of about 2 platoons each. Something had to be done, and done quickly.